Our next case is 11-1569, the State of Ohio versus Lawrence Dibble. For the appellant, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to focus on the first and second propositions of law today. Under the second proposition of law, it's our assertion that the court should conclude that the detective was not making a false statement when he used the phrase victim number two regarding the second female mentioned in the search warrant affidavit. Contrary to the views of the lower courts, the word victim is not limited to victims of crime. The normal understanding of that word extends to other people who have been wronged, deceived, or manipulated. This broader understanding of the word victim is consistent with substantive Fourth Amendment law. I cite, the dissent below cites, and the amicus brief cite the Ventresca case, which recognizes that search warrant affidavits should be interpreted not in a hyper-technical fashion, but in a common-sense fashion used by non-lawyers. I would also submit that substantive Fourth Amendment law does not require that a particular incident be criminal in order for it to support the issuance of a search warrant. As our briefing shows, the Fourth Amendment mere evidence standard allows a search for evidence if it will be if the evidence will aid in an apprehension or conviction. Under that mere evidence standard, evidence can have relevance not because it shows that a crime was involved, but because it shows other matters related to another incident that is criminal, such as modus operandi, or other matters that are relevant. And I cite the Messerschmitt case in my brief for that proposition, which just came out a few months ago out of the U.S. Supreme Court. So victim number two did not need to be a victim of crime in order for her incidents, in order for the incidents occurring between her and the defendant to be relevant to the issues of modus operandi, grooming, manipulation, motive, sexual purpose, in regard to the crime committed against victim number one.
In our view, research show that this has occurred in other contexts, either terms other than victim one or other terms. What other cases have you found that are parallel to this?
I never did find a case that specifically involves the word victim, and if you would do a search based on the word victim and these issues, you would just pull up so many cases that it wouldn't be productive. I think so we just go to
basic alternate terms.
Alternate terms?
Yeah, other than victim. Without naming the individual.
I didn't see any case law addressing. I didn't find any, Your Honor.
So is this case unique?
It's. I would say it is unique in the sense that the lower courts were applying a strict definition of a word and applying that after the fact to what the detective had said in a search warrant affidavit, and I think that's improper.
Should we look at this as a good faith exception to a rule?
I believe the
good interplay in your view.
I believe the lower court's use of that strict definition plays into a couple issues. First off, under the broader definition that I think the detective could reasonably believe he could use, it's not false. But even if you say, oh, we're going to apply this strict definition that it's only victims of crime that you should be referring to when you say victim in a search warrant affidavit, then that plays into the issue of whether the detective was acting knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly in regard to using that issue, using that term. And also you have the good faith exception in combination with that. I cite Davis versus United States, which involves a search incident to arrest, but I think it's relevant here because that case involved a situation where the search was valid when it happened, but later case law said the search was bad. And the U.S. Supreme Court said good faith exception applies in that situation. Essentially, we had the same situation. There was no case law saying or informing the detective that the word victim should be limited to victims of crime.
Does your office meet with those who draft these on occasion for instructional purposes? I mean, what's so hard about affiant? I mean, everybody who comes in is sworn, and we always talk about an affiant.
Our office does not generally meet with the affiants. They have in-house counsel generally, and they have legal advice in-house, I believe, to answer those questions that they may have.
What does in-house mean?
They're legal advisor.
What?
The local police departments have legal advisors who can advise them if they have questions. But I don't think there's anything wrong with using the shorthand phrase victim number two in relation to this particular person.
So you think victim would be a substitute for affiant?
Well, she wasn't the affiant. She was she could have been referred to as an informant, a citizen number two. You know, there are other terms, but using victim number two was not inappropriate.
Right.
It was not false.
Mr. Taylor, as I look, this whole victim seems to be a red herring from the Court of Appeals. When I'm looking at the affidavit the police officer filed, he says that she had graduated from high school, where Mr. Dibble had also been her teacher. I mean, there's nothing here to try to make victim number two appear to be a child in school. The affidavit is clear.
Well, that's one of my arguments as well, that it was clear from the affidavit, and the judge would have understood that the police officer was using the term victim in a broader sense, not in the victim of crime sense.
So do we have to find 41C unconstitutional to rule in your favor? Do the two go together? Because I don't see that that's necessary.
Well, no, you don't need to reach that issue. I would accept victory.
Good answer.
I guess I have a similar problem in that I look at the record and I look at the affidavit and I look at the circumstances, and my problem is I don't have as much a problem with the word victim. I have a problem with the judge finding that was in a deliberate intent to mislead the court. What evidence was there that led the judge or could have led the judge to that conclusion? Because when you read it, it's clearly, you know, above 18, it's not a child. It looks like the grooming that's happening to a true victim, number one, who's underage. So what was the judge's basis for finding that this was false? Because to me, that's more the problem than even the use of the word victim.
Well, the trial judge basically said victim means victim of crime, and that was the only connotation that the court was willing to accept, and everything went downhill from there as far as the court's analysis of intent or state of mind of the detective.
The court made the conclusion that because you used victim to describe a similar conduct behavior, even though the affidavit clearly said the person was over 18, that meant that the officer was deliberately trying to get the court to issue the warrant. That's what the judge ended up interpolating from all this?
Well, the court did mention that the officer was trying to get the court to issue the warrant, and obviously when you go to a judge with a search warrant request, you want the judge to issue the warrant. The question is whether you're making a false statement and you're being intentionally or recklessly false in doing it. And I don't think the use of the word victim in relation to this person is invalid. And when you look at what the detective knew about what this defendant had done to this person, I the word victim is highly appropriate. When you look at the fact that when she was a student, and the detective knew this, when she was a student, he manipulated her into giving him bareback massages while she was still a student, and then he was conning her and other students into having their photos taken in see-through unitards. He's exploiting his status as a father figure and as the theater director. And when you take into account the incident where he cons her into a naked photography session as an adult, he clearly had manipulated her, conned her. The detective used the term brainwashed. I think clearly the word victim is an appropriate term. The only way you can find it inappropriate is to say that the only definition we will allow, the only connotation of the word victim we will allow in a search warrant affidavit is to say victim of crime. And I think that's inconsistent with substantive Fourth Amendment case law. And it's inconsistent with the notion that we interpret these terms in search warrant affidavits in common sense ways, not in hyper-technical ways.
Mr. Taylor, getting to the actual finding or the actual signing of this affidavit and so on, there's some statement in your brief that suggests that there was oral commentary made. And I just want to clarify, we're talking about looking at the terms of the affidavit in and of themselves without any extraneous information. Is that correct?
Well, in determining falsity, you look at everything the detective knew.
We're talking about what the detached magistrate knew in terms of probable cause to issue the warrant. And I just want to clarify that you're not saying that an officer can go to a magistrate with an affidavit and then give extraneous information to support that affidavit. You're not saying that, are you?
We are saying that in our first proposition of law. And the reason for that is the fourth, there's Criminal Rule 41, let me back up and explain why I think the oral information is important. First off, he did inform the court of the of some of these incidents and I believe of the MO involving both girls. I think that goes, and there's case law from the 5th and 12th District that recognizes that at a minimum, the sworn oral information should play into the issue of whether the good faith exception applies. And in my view, it should also play into the issue of whether the detective was acting intentionally or with reckless disregard of falsity. So
you're still saying that a detached magistrate can not only look at the affidavit, the four corners, and there's case law out there that says that's what magistrates are to do, but that they can then question the witness who's giving the sworn statement and add to that? I mean, to use that oral testimony as well?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The court can question the affiant, and that's under the statute and, I believe, under Criminal Rule 41. Now, the issue becomes, in this case, what is the effect of the fact that that was not recorded and made a part of the affidavit? Because Criminal Rule 41C says when you do that oral presentation, you question the affiant, it needs to be recorded, transcribed, and made a part of the affidavit.
Exactly, made a part of the affidavit, so everybody knows what the foundation for the warrant was.
And our position is that is unconstitutional for two reasons. First off, the Fourth Amendment, and I cite the Clyburn case out of the Fourth Circuit, which recognizes that the Fourth Amendment has no recordation requirement. All it requires is sworn information, not sworn recorded information. So when the criminal rule goes beyond that and superimposes a recording requirement, it's going beyond the Fourth Amendment. And when it excludes that evidence from a suppression hearing, it's basically preventing the state from showing that the issuance of the warrant was valid under Fourth Amendment standards. And we believe that's unconstitutional, not only because of the fact that mainly because a procedural rule should not have a substantive effect, and I believe that it would have the substantive effect of de facto modifying the Fourth Amendment to have a recording requirement.
Counsel, have we ever held that a rule of this court was unconstitutional because it afforded greater protection than the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence might require?
Well,
I'm having a hard time understanding how that's unconstitutional. Maybe it's unwise, but unconstitutional. Do we even have to find that for you to prevail here today?
This court has said that it will only exclude evidence if the Fourth Amendment is if there is a constitutional violation. So when you have additional information, which I think can be considered on the intent issues, on the good faith exception anyway, regardless of 41C, and on the falsity issue, but even if when you get to the point where we're trying to introduce evidence at a suppression hearing that would show the Fourth Amendment was not violated, that is a de facto substantive expansion of the Fourth Amendment into having a recording requirement, and we believe that's unconstitutional.
But we can do that, can't we?
No, I don't believe you can. You're limited.
We can't afford greater protection for the citizens of the state than the Fourth Amendment federal jurisprudence.
Your rulemaking power is limited to procedural matters, not substantive matters. And so that's the basic problem with it. But I think the broader issue is that there is no suppression unless there is a constitutional violation. You have to find the Fourth Amendment was violated. And so you have to look at the Fourth Amendment standards. And if the Fourth Amendment was not violated, and it wasn't here because the additional sworn oral information can be considered under the Fourth Amendment, then you don't have a Fourth Amendment violation. You have no suppression.
Counsel, isn't maybe the underlying problem here and the why of how the trial judge and the Court of Appeals came out is that the second person, there's no crime. It's consenting adults. And perhaps the judges are looking at this and saying, if you've only got this one incident with the one underage girl, that would not be a basis to go looking for computers and all that kind of stuff. The basis for looking for this stuff at his home had to do with the adult, and the activities were between consenting adults. Isn't that the drift of it? I mean, the activity with victim number one has nothing to do with photographs or computers or any of that, if I'm understanding the facts correctly.
Well, you have two things going on. You have what is mentioned in the search warrant affidavit, the written part, and you have the sworn oral information. As I said earlier, the Fourth Amendment does not require that a particular incident be criminal in order for it to provide a basis for the issuance of a search warrant. And the Messerschmitt case, I believe, is an example. It talks about you being able to search for evidence of motive. A particular incident doesn't need to be criminal in order for it to bear relevance to commit another crime.
If a teacher here slides his hand up the skirt of a student, that's sufficient to go get a warrant to go to his house, look for his computer, look for his cameras, all the things that they were looking for here.
When you have another student who is manipulated and groomed the same way as this student, and who ultimately you can see how it played out with that second student, where into adulthood he's still conning her into sexual activities. And I think that it shows where it was all going, and it's relevant to his sexual purpose in committing the crime and his motive and his MO in relation to the first student. So that's one of the reasons why the search of the home was valid. The sworn oral information provides another reason why you could search the home, because it shows that the defendant lied to the students and said, you have to be completely naked under these unitards, put the unitards on, and I have to take pictures of you. And obviously, he was going to keep these things, and I cite the Byrne case out of the Rhode Island Supreme Court, which talks about, these types of offenders keep these things. They hoard them. And so it's a reasonable inference to search his home, too. But the basic issue in this case is, first of all, whether the defense has shown falsity. Its motion to suppress was based on Franks versus Delaware. It hasn't shown falsity. The motion to suppress should have been denied. And so at a minimum, you reverse that. You get into these other issues. If you find falsity and you find it was intentional, you get into the issue of whether what was left would have supported the search anyway. And I believe it would, based on you could still consider what happened to victim number two. You can call her informant number two. You could still consider it. And you also consider the sworn oral information, too, under Fourth Amendment standards. I'm sure my time is way expired, and we'll reserve whatever I have left. Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, opposing counsel, my name is David Thomas, and I represent the appellee in this case, Lawrence Dibble. Your Honors, to follow up on some of the comments from earlier, and especially from Justice O'Donnell, we would agree completely with the court that facts of this case are unique, but, Your Honors, what's not unique is what happened below, and that is that the trial court and the Court of Appeals applied this court's standards and the rules of criminal procedure and well-settled rules of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence in finding, first, that suppression was the appropriate remedy in this case, and then on de novo review by the 10th Appellate District, taking a look at the complete record in this case offered by both parties, that, in fact, that ruling was correct, that it was supported by competent and credible evidence, and, in fact, that the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas did exactly what it has been tasked to do by the United States Supreme Court and by this court, which is to evaluate evidence placed in front of it by the parties and make a determination about whether there has been a constitutional violation.
Counsel, what about the issue that there was a little surprise in this case because they thought this was a preliminary issue to see whether you could even get to a hearing on whether or not there was a falsity in it, but it somehow suddenly blended into one, and at least the trial, the judge who issued the search warrant could have been a witness, filed an affidavit later, but was never a part of this proceeding.
Well, Your Honor, if there's any surprise in this case, it was brought on by the state of Ohio. This has caused all of us to take a very close look at Franks, and there's an important difference between the standard that the Supreme Court set out in Franks versus Delaware and what the state is now using in its briefs to claim that there was surprise. The state uses the phrase full hearing and then characterizes what occurred in the common pleas court here as a preliminary hearing. Well, Franks says nothing at all about that. Franks versus Delaware, all of the federal progeny and all the cases that this court has issued determining how Franks is supposed to work, none of them call for that procedure. Instead, what Franks says and what this court has said in interpreting it is if you're a defendant and you're moving to suppress evidence, you're not entitled to any evidentiary hearing at all unless you can make a preliminary showing. And so at a minimum, if the state had had any problems having an evidentiary hearing, it could have entered an objection prior to the commencement of the proceeding before the common pleas court. But the record goes on from that, Your Honor. The state asked questions of the witness. The state never said, you know what, we're not entitled, or rather the defense is not entitled to a hearing under Franks because there's been no prima facie showing. And, in fact, at the conclusion of the proceedings, at the conclusion of the transcript in this case, which is only 53 pages long, the state asks the trial court to make a ruling on the merits of the suppression motion. They don't say, we shouldn't have been here at all because the defense has failed to make its showing under Franks.
I have a question on the affidavit. The trial court's opinion seems to clearly hang its hat on the use of the word victim for number two. If the affidavit had just said informant number two and not called her a victim, was the information in the affidavit about what happened to informant number two, starting in her as a student and going into adulthood, would that have been permissible for the judge to consider in issuing the affidavit?
No, Your Honor. In fact, we made this argument to the Court of Appeals. As you said, if you take victim number two and you just make it informant number two, and ironically that suggestion actually came from the Fraternal Order of Police as amicus, I think, at the end of that analysis, Justice Stratton, there's just nothing that points to Lawrence Dibble's house. There's nothing, you know, that says because of this relationship that he had with you know, person number two or, you know,
even though he was doing all the same activities with number two that he had was starting to do with one, and all that clearly looked like grooming. I mean, you know, some of that behavior was not what you would consider normal behavior for a teacher to a student. That you say that's not relevant and not admissible, even just as facts out that all go to the behavior of the defendant?
Well, I may have misunderstood your question, Your Honor. What I understood was, you know, does informant number two sort of, does that get you into Mr. Dibble's door? Because that's really what this is about. And I would submit it doesn't. And the reason is that the behavior that was described with respect to this person, and there's ample testimony about this in the trial court record, is that there was behavior in other states and at other points in time. And
okay, you're not saying that the trial court issuing the affidavit could not consider informant number two's testimony or information, that it just wasn't sufficient.
I think a trial court can consider any information in an affidavit, but I think in this case, nothing about that person, however we describe her, Your Honor, points back to Lawrence Dibble's house. And I would submit part of that, Your Honor, to kind of follow up on.
How can it not point back to his house? She says in the affidavit it's alleged he took nude photos of her vaginal area during their meetings. He used a digital camera to take the photos, made her wear a pillowcase over her head while he took the photos. How does that not lead back to his house? Where do you think those photos are kept?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. But what I would say is that, first of all, the affidavit from the affiant didn't say, well, I think it's going to be at his house. And second, it turned out in listening to the trial court testimony that, in fact, you know, these photos were taken in other places. It was an incomplete. In other words, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it turned out, thanks to Franks, that information was incomplete. And then, in fact, you know, those photos may or may not have been at his house, but if you just look at that affidavit, it's not apparent that they would have been there.
Counsel, can I ask you the first general question for me is it necessary to limit the person who's looking at the affidavit to the four corners of the affidavit to determine whether to search, to issue a search warrant?
Well, as a matter of law, Your Honor, I would say that it's not. This is the situation that Rule 41C deals with, this court's issue of rule.
This is what I'm having trouble with. At least eight appellate courts have said, generally, the person who is signing the warrant to search is limited to what is put in front of that judge at the time of the request. And you do not discuss anything with the individual affiant unless that is then put in the affidavit. We have eight appellate judges, or eight appellate courts, rather, 34 cases that have said that. We have not. And I just want to clarify what your position is.
Well, our position is, of course, at the risk of making the state's argument here, there are a lot of ways that, to use the colloquial, a search can be saved that can justify an entry such as Mr. Dibble's. So the first is that a warrant is defective. That's what addresses your concern, Your Honor. And that's what Rule 41C says, is that if information is going to be given to a neutral detached magistrate, as it was here, must be sworn, must be recorded, it must be in an affidavit. I think courts have provided some other limited circumstances, but none of those apply to what's known as the probable cause analysis. They may apply to Leon and good faith. And so there are these kind of extraneous circumstances where it can apply. But on the face of it, Your Honor, I agree completely. And on behalf of Mr. Dibble, we do, that the issue is what's in the four corners of the affidavit and what was in front of that magistrate.
All right. So you are taking a different position from the state then? If I understand it correctly, they're saying that there can be statements made to the magistrate in addition that are not recorded, and that can furnish the basis for probable cause for a search.
Yes.
You're not saying that.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
No.
Well, how about the question of whether or not it was truthful testimony or not? Not so much the substance, but whether or not it was a false testimony or not. I noticed the phrasing in the rule says, if you have the oral examination under oath, such testimony shall be admissible at a hearing if it's taken by a court. But nowhere does it say it shall not be admissible for some other purpose, does it?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's kind of a follow-up to the question we were discussing earlier, and that, again, I hate to make the state's argument here, but it actually was considered in this case, and I think it's instructive, and it's going to get to your answer, Your Honor, and that is that, in fact, what this other testimony did was it educated the common pleas court judge who was hearing the motion to suppress about the whole context of the issuance of the search warrant and the manner in which this whole situation came about. Your Honor, the trial court judge, the common pleas court judge I'm referring to, describes in his decision, he says he had an opportunity to hear all of the testimony from the affiant, from the detective who obtained the search warrant. And it was based on all of that. based on his observations of the testimony, based on, to follow up on Justice Stratton's earlier concern, other information in the case, such as the fact that he was inconsistent in his use of the term victim, because the only time the word victim appeared in the whole file in this case was in his efforts to obtain the search warrant. It isn't in any reports. He conceded that he didn't have any probable cause to file criminal charges with respect to that person, and in fact that her information was necessary in his own mind. This was the testimony, Your Honor, to gain entry into Mr. Dibble's home. So what happened here was the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas did exactly what it has been tasked with doing, which is it evaluated the evidence in front of it and was in the unique position to observe the credibility and the appearance and the demeanor of the witnesses, which is exactly what it's been commanded to do by the United States Supreme Court and by this court, and it made a determination about what, of course, has turned out to be one of the critical issues in this case. And that court was in a unique position. None of the rest of us were there, but that court did that, and it made a ruling that we submit, and the Court of Appeals agreed was supported by competent and credible evidence. And so, Your Honor, to the extent there's a problem with that, that would be an issue of error correction. It's not a new issue of law. It's an issue that the state has with how the ruling came down.
But is your argument then grounded on the basis of the use of the term victim as to the individual who was a consenting adult and not a victim? Or does your argument transcend that position?
It's part of my argument, for sure, Your Honor, but I would submit that we would prevail whether the word victim had been used or not for the reasons I was attempting to address earlier, which is, at the end of it, there simply wasn't probable cause to believe that there was going to be some evidence of this crime regarding victim number one in Mr. Dibble's home. And so the word victim is important, for sure, and I think it's part of the context. And, you know, it's telling, Your Honor, that on the one hand, you know, the Supreme Court has commanded, and certainly in the last 25 years has said, trial court judges have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And that's exactly what Judge Horton did in this case, was he considered the totality, and as we're reviewing it here today, victims got to be part of that totality because that's the standard that's come down from the U.S. Supreme Court. Having said that, hypothetically, I think the search is still invalid without the word victim.
Thank you.
Your Honors, just to conclude my comments, I see that my time is about to expire. What we offer to the court today is that this is not a case of unique law. This is not a case that calls on this court to change the law or interpret the law. Instead, what happened in this case is it was a case that was unique to its facts. It was a case of a police detective who overreached in a search warrant affidavit, and a trial court and a court of appeals did exactly what they've been asked to do, which they applied the standards of this court and the rules of this court in evaluating evidence and the law and making rulings. Your Honor, for those reasons, we would request that the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas and the Franklin County Court of Appeals be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor.
Just briefly, a couple points, Your Honors. We stand by the third proposition of law, which talks about how we believe the hearing was mishandled, the comments at the beginning, et cetera, and I really don't have time to go into it further, but stand by that. As far as we have the unusual situation where the court said, detective, you lied. You intentionally falsified by using the word victim, but then the court says, the court would find few people, if any, who would argue with the notion that even minimal levels of manipulation and control exerted over young adult women by older men violate grounds of immorality and may create some measure of victimization. The trial court itself was conceding that victim number two was a victim. He just didn't like the fact, and he thought it was wrong that she wasn't a victim of crime. And as I point out in my briefing, she didn't need to be a victim of crime in order to be a victim under normal understandings of that term, and she didn't need to be a victim of crime under Fourth Amendment standards in order for her incident to be relevant. And so for all these reasons, we would ask that the court reverse and remand to the trial court for further proceedings.
So, counsel, do you believe that just the contents of the affidavit would have been sufficient without the additional oral testimony that hasn't been recorded?
Yes, I believe the incident with victim number two, mentioned in the affidavit, would have been enough to justify a search of the defendant's home for evidence of MO, sexual purpose, manipulation, grooming, etc. I believe the sworn oral information provides a second basis, and under the Fourth Amendment could be considered by the court and should be considered by the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.